Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge William Pryor. We are here this afternoon to hear oral argument in the case of Ledford versus Warden. Who do we have to present argument on behalf of Mr. Ledford today?
Good morning, or good afternoon, Your Honor. Jeffrey Ertl on behalf of Michael Ledford.
Mr. Ertl, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to today start by with the first issue being the JEB versus Alabama issue. I'd also then follow it up with discussing the ineffective assistance of counsel, and time permitting, we'll briefly touch on the what we call the juror misconduct claim. Judge, the first thing is trial counsel raised an objection to the state's use of peremptory challenges to eliminate women and said a JEB versus Alabama. This court must give examine this through the lens of the effective Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and says that which says that this court must determine whether the state court's determination was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established Supreme Court precedent, or and relevant to this case, it resulted in a decision based on an unreasonable determination of the facts and light of the evidence. The Georgia Supreme Court's resolution of this issue satisfies all three. First of all, it's our position that the Georgia Supreme Court added a burden to the analysis when it required something additional than a pattern of strikes, because our position is that Batson has, and its progeny, which JEB versus Alabama is, obviously, says that a pattern of strike can give rise to a prima facie case of discrimination, and we believe the evidence will show that a pattern of strikes did just that. Secondly,
so, Mr. Ertl, this is Judge Newsom. Let me just maybe to kick us off here a little bit. How do you deal, though, with the existing precedent in this court, cases like Hill and Campa, that if not precisely the statistics, if not precisely on point, are what I'll call pretty doggone close, which it seems like, given your burden under AEDPA, has got to be good enough.
Well,
how is this case so demonstrably distinguishable, so much worse than those? And in Campa, of course, we actually, you know, turned around the decision below. So how could this be an unreasonable application of, in light of Hill and Campa?
Well, first, I think that the district court and the state have misapprehended what Hill has said. And Hill, for example, there was a veneer of 54 potential jurors, 22 of which were African-American, were black. It was a Batson claim. The government used nine of 14 strikes, to remove 41% of the potential black jurors. Ultimately, the jury consisted of 50% African-Americans. Hill did not say that statistics alone can never support a prima facie case. Hill said that these statistics, and the district court and the state, the respondent, have not used these statistics. And those statistics, according to Hill, without more, do not make out a prima facie case. In this
our
case,
own precedents, though, say that the trial court has to consider the totality of the circumstances to determine whether there's a pattern that creates an inference of discrimination, right?
Correct.
If it's a number of factors that have to be considered, I don't understand how what the Georgia Supreme Court said about that is inconsistent with what we have said.
Well, I think what this court has said in Ochoa Vasquez is statistical evidence may support an inference of discrimination, but only when it's placed in context. And the court said, for example, the number of persons struck.
So the statistical disparity wouldn't do it alone. You'd have to consider it in context. You'd have to consider a number of factors. Isn't that consistent with what the Georgia Supreme Court said?
Right, but the statistics, they had, Ochoa says things like only one couple of other information, such as the composition of the Vannar and the race of the other struck. All of that evidence was before the Georgia Supreme Court and the court of the trial court. And they then said, no, you still have to have more evidence besides the pattern in context. And that, I think, is contrary to Batson and contrary to this court's precedent. At least
but that's not, counsel, this is Lisa Branch. That's not what the Georgia Supreme Court said. It looked at the strikes and the number of strikes, and then it just said, and then we find that there's nothing else, that Ledford failed to present any additional facts. How is that statement that without the statistical evidence and without anything more, how is that supporting what you're saying the Georgia Supreme Court has said?
The Georgia Supreme Court said that statistics in context is not enough. That's the way I read the Georgia Supreme Court's decision. Because they had, before it, the statistics in context. They had the makeup of the Vannar. They had the other peoples that were struck by...
Well, let's say we disagree with you that that's what the Georgia Supreme Court said, right? Let's say that we understand them to be saying that that you have to look at the whole picture, which is what we've said as well. And when you look at that, you've got a Vannari here that's 36 persons, 15 women, 21 men. The state exercises 9 of its strikes to remove women, but it also accepted 6 women. Ledford struck 4 women. How do we, when we look at the totality of the circumstances, how would we say that the decision of the Georgia Supreme Court was an unreasonable application of something clearly established by the Supreme Court?
Well, if you take Batson itself, and Batson was meant to be a sort of a permissive standard because Swain was much too difficult to master. And we're talking about strictly, and that all we have to do is raise an inference of discrimination. And that pattern of strikes in context raises an inference, and it's clearly it's an unreasonable application of Batson and his progeny, and it's an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented under 2254 D2. Using 75% of your strikes, 3/4 of a party's strikes, to eliminate approximately 2/3 of the potential women jurors raises an inference that there's something is amiss. And therefore, Batson, and is Johnson, the court in Johnson, California v. Johnson, or Johnson v. California, said that this is not an onerous burden. It is a burden of production, not a burden of persuasion at this point. And we've put forth that evidence. And finding that there's no prima facie case is clearly an unreasonable application and clearly an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence before the state courts.
But counsel, you acknowledge that the presence of women on this jury does, under our precedent, undercut any gender-based percentage challenges, if you look at our case in U.S. v. Allison and U.S. v. Puentes.
Right, but this court's precedent really is not material to state court determinations.
I'm going to disagree with you on that point. It is true that we have to measure how the Supreme Court of Georgia decides this issue against Supreme Court precedent. But it would seem to me we've said many times that to the extent that what the Georgia Supreme Court says is consistent with our own precedents, our own understanding of Supreme Court precedent, we would be hard-pressed to say that what the Georgia Supreme Court held was an unreasonable application of clearly established Supreme Court precedent. If they view it the same way we do, how are we going to say that's unreasonable?
Well, I think what we look at, I think this court, given these facts, would find that this a prima facie case was made, because I believe
that
we
have... That brings us back to Judge Newsom's questions about, for example, Hill or Campa. I mean, in Campa, the government used 78% of its strikes against black jurors, 9 out of 11, and we reversed a decision that the defendant had established a prima facie case based on that fact alone.
I'm sorry, Judge, I was looking at Camp, and it looked like they only struck 7. They challenged only 7. Maybe they only challenged 7 of the peremptory strikes, but I could not tell in looking at Campa.
This is Judge Newsom. In Campa, my notes show that in Campa, the government was allotted 11, used 9, and 7 of those 9 were used against African Americans.
Right.
So 78% of those used, or 64% of those allotted. In either case, I just can't imagine that you are so far outside Hill and Campa that this should be deemed an unreasonable application of the underlying principles that birthed Hill and Campa.
Well, I think our position is, I understand, our position is that when you use three-quarters of your strikes to eliminate two-thirds of the potential African or women jurors, that raises an inference. Again, it's a low bar. It raises an inference of discrimination that should allow the court then to try and ferret out if, in fact, it was. We admit we cannot carry the burden of showing discrimination at the first stage, and the first prong is not, that's not a stage we're meant to try and show the ultimate issue. So our position is it's unreasonable because it does not allow the court to get to step 2 and then ultimately to step 3 in making a final decision. And Batson was meant to be, give the court the opportunity to try and ferret out discrimination in what would normally be a process that is ripe for discrimination, I think this the Supreme Court has said.
Can I just ask you a quick question to kind of tease out the limits of this a little bit? So if 9 of 12... 75% to exclude 66%, you say too much. What if this had been 8 of 12, exclusion of the same portion of the veneer, or, I don't know, we get down to 7 of 12? So sliding scale-ish to me. I just don't really understand where the principle leaves off.
Well, I'm not asking for a bright line rule. I'm saying that in this case, that this pattern of strikes in context gives rise to an inference, and a finding that there was no inference of discrimination is contrary to Batson and its progeny. And it's an unreasonable finding or determination of fact in light of the evidence presented. Should this court say that, and I believe there is some precedent that this court says that the prima facie determination is fact-based, it's a fact-finding. And, Judge, I would point out that, you know, there are a litany of cases saying that just one strike alone is enough to one strike exercise for discriminatory reasons is enough to violate the Constitution. And that's the standard that's the prism that this court has to look through.
Don't we have to look at the alternates? Precedents have looked at alternates.
I think you do. If you find that that you're not bound by the AEDPA, I think Pinholster says you have to look at the claim the way the state courts looked at it. So I think in either case we satisfy the burden. But I think at this point,
the alternates, we have a venari of 43, right, with 18 being women.
Right.
The state accepts all three female alternates. So it ends up accepting 9 of the 18 women, or 50% of the women, and used 69% of its strikes against women, which brings us basically in the same position as Campa and Hill.
Judge, I think there's another fact in there that the court needs to take into account. The state tried to use another strike against a woman, and was prevented because of the way that the court conducted the voir dire here. So I think you're looking at,
that's because it had already used its alternate peremptory strike on a man, though, right?
Correct. That's correct. And they said
I don't know if that really helps you much.
Well, they tried to use it, and they were told not to.
But they first did it on a man, and that's what prevented them from doing it. But they were not able to because they had already used that strike for a man.
Correct. But the idea is they thought they had another strike, and they were going to strike another woman, and they couldn't. Mm-hmm. So you have there, like I said, 9 of 13, 70% to remove 50%.
So what brings you across the line is what they wanted to do but couldn't.
Well, I think when you talk about looking at all of the circumstances, that's one of the circumstances.
Well, surely what matters is what actually happened, not what they could have done if they could have under a different scenario. What really matters in establishing the pattern for a prima facie case is what actually counted as a strike.
No, I think that's like you said.
What in clearly established Supreme Court precedent tells us that's not right?
Well, I think in Batson clearly says that a pattern of strikes is sufficient to.
But it didn't say a pattern of strikes and of hypothetical strikes.
No, but
what they would have done if they could have.
No, considering what they wanted to do is just like considering what type of questions they asked of the jurors, which is one of the things that this court in Ochoa says, is that's to put it in context. You put it in context, they were trying to strike even more women from the jury, and that's just part of all of the circumstances that.
Well, if we were going to start including them, I mean that's like saying, but then they get to come forward and say, well, but if we had had one extra peremptory strike, we would have struck a man. I mean, that's so speculative that I don't know how it could possibly be considered.
I think it's considered under all of the circumstances. Like you said earlier, it's like the court has to consider all of it. The strike, the people, the race of the people struck, the context. This is context.
Okay. Do you want to? Do you have really anything more for us about the?
Well, I will point out that I think that this court in Campo actually did consider what the hypothetical said. You know, they did not attempt to exclude all the black jurors, as many blacks as it could, from the jury. That's speculation too. I mean, it's stating a fact about the record and drawing an inference from it. If there are no further questions, I will move on to the ineffective assistance counsel claim. As the court's well aware, the standard here is, again, governed by the ADPA, and the clearly established Supreme Court precedent is Strickland. And in order to prevail, we must show that two prongs, and both of them are mandatory, that the counsel performed efficiently, and secondly, that the defendant was prejudiced. Efficient performance is to be evaluated by prevailing professional norms, and then prejudice in a state like Georgia is there's a reasonable probability that at least one juror would have struck a different balance. Here, trial counsel had the opportunity to prevent the jury from hearing any evidence about antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy.
The thing I wonder about when I look at this case is you had a very experienced defense team, a team that has had success in defending death penalty cases, and they get a bad case, it looks like to me. I mean, innocence is not a viable theory of defense, it seems to me, nor if your concern is avoiding a death sentence, does an argument that, you know, this is really not a heinous enough crime to merit the death sentence, that doesn't look like a winner. And they explore mental health mitigation to try to explain why it is that this defendant might have done what he did in a way that would, you know, reduce the notion that he was morally culpable, blameworthy, and, you know, they're kind of stuck with it may not be the greatest defense, but it may be the least bad option available to them.
Well, Judge, I think, first of all, this court's decisions and the training that they had, you know, have told them that this type of antisocial personality disorder evidence and psychopathy evidence is extremely aggravating. This court in Weeks
said it can hurt you. There's no doubt. We said the fact that you don't present it, it can be a reasonable decision. But we've also, Morton, I know you don't like Morton. You might be surprised that I think Morton's right.
I'm not going to argue with that. I think Morton's different because Morton didn't have the opportunity to foreclose the introduction. They had to get out in front of stuff that the state had the right to bring in. Here, they could have prevented that.
Yeah, but very clearly says that it's not a per se.
No, no.
It's not per se deficient performance to present this kind of evidence.
I'm not asking for a per se rule, and I agree with you. You can't. I don't think the court could do it under Eddings and those cases. I don't think the court could say you can't present this. But I think
and as bad as this case was for them, why was it not only unreasonable for the for the defense counsel to make this choice, but either contrary to or unreasonable application of Strickland to make that choice?
Because it is so bad, and given the facts of this case, when they had...
Prepared to what? What would you have had to do?
They introduced compelling evidence in mitigation that was completely negated. And essentially erased by then introducing antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy. They had evidence of that would invoke sympathy from a jury. They had, and the Supreme Court has recognized in Porter, Williams, that mitigating evidence that humanizes the defendant creates a reasonable probability of a different outcome. Yet they had that. They had all sorts of evidence like
that.
Well,
he clearly had a bad childhood, right? Horrible childhood, had a fall, but they could reasonably also understand that a lot of Georgians, maybe even members of the jury or people who are familiar to members of the jury, have bad childhoods, have bad events in their life, and don't do this kind of crime. And the mental health evidence helps complete the picture.
I will disagree with. There's no. I don't think a trial attorney should complete the picture when the completed picture says he is irredeemable, that he is not human and instead is a monster. We use psychopath to describe the worst criminals and the worst people we know: Adolf Hitler, Charles Manson.
But counsel, they were able to in their presentation of the mental health evidence. They were also able to get in some of the medical testimony that he had suffered the brain injury when in the fall from a tree at a young age. And while there was certainly disagreement, evidence brought up by the state that disagreed with that, you know, it was one piece of the mental health puzzle to explain why he had committed such a heinous crime. And aren't you, in saying that they shouldn't have presented it, aren't you engaging in exactly the kind of strategic choice analysis that Strickland is going to stop us from doing?
No, Strickland says that even strategic choices can be unreasonable. It might be a rare case,
You have 2 minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. And I think Buck versus Davis is the perfect example of it. The trial attorney made a strategic decision to present the mental health evidence that presented very aggravating circumstances, and the Supreme Court said that was ineffective. They shouldn't have done that. It's the same thing here. There's very little difference between what happened in Buck that proved he's a future danger than introducing here the fact that the psychopath, and I point out that it's one thing for the state to argue it, but the defense argued it. The defense and the prejudice from it is patent when you look at some of the things, the way that the defense attorney described Ledford at trial. He does things without considering the consequences, without being aware of the harm he's inflicting, and without having empathy for other individuals. And that's the trial attorney, his defense attorney. And they talk about he's thinking in terms of, this is what I want, and I'm going to get it, and if I don't get it, you're in trouble. That's the defense attorney describing his client, because by introducing that evidence, he was sort of locked into that. If he could have presented a very compelling evidence case in mitigation without that, and if you take that out, the entire sentencing picture is changed and different and much more compelling, and there's a reasonable probability that at least one of the jurors would have sentenced him to, or would have opted for something less than death.
This is Judge Newsom. Can I ask you very, very briefly a procedural question about your juror misconduct
sure.
claim? So it looks to me from reading the record that the only theory of cause that you presented to the district court was that counsel was ineffective for failing to probe the issue. And now, before us, you seem to be riding a different horse. You seem to be, saying that under Williams versus Taylor, there was no indication that would have given your client or counsel, presumably, reason to probe it. And so my question is, especially given the fact that those two theories seem to me to be very nearly mutually exclusive of one another, why is it that you haven't forfeited the Williams versus Taylor theory of cause in this court?
Well, I think we probably pled it in the alternative, but I think when we discovered the communication, we asked, and this was in post-conviction, and I use the we collectively, we asked to subpoena the jurors, and we were denied, and that's the Williams versus Taylor aspect of it.
Maybe a misunderstanding. I'm saying that when you got to the federal district court, the only theory of cause to excuse your state procedural default that you argued was ineffective assistance. And I agree with you that ineffective assistance can, in certain circumstances, constitute cause. But that's not really the argument you're making before us. Instead, you're making before us a Williams versus Taylor argument for cause. And I'm just saying, do you think you can fairly change horses between the district court and here? Why haven't you forfeited the Williams versus Taylor argument here by not raising it in the district court?
I think we raised it in the district court that we were not allowed to call the jurors at the hearing, and therefore we did not fail to develop the record in state post-conviction. I think you have to, and I think that's why in state
Well, that's different from a we had no reason argument.
Yeah, I thought your cause argument now, at least your principal cause argument now is, the reason that we didn't probe is because who could have known? Just like in Williams versus Taylor, no one could have thought about probing this juror's supposed lies. Now, I think that's in some tension with your ineffective assistance argument for cause, which is
tension.
It was so obvious that even the attorney.
I'm sorry.
That would be an understatement. If it, tension. I mean, it's completely the opposite of the ineffective assistance.
I do not think we're saying Williams versus Taylor gives us cause to excuse the procedural default on direct appeal. I think we were using Williams versus Taylor to show why we hadn't failed to develop the record, and that's why we should have gotten an evidentiary hearing.
I'm clear, your sole cause argument to excuse the procedural default is ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, I believe yes, I think it is.
Okay.
You saved your time for rebuttal. Unless, Judge Newsom, do you have a...
No, that's helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Let's hear from the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Clint Malcolm on behalf of the appellee. May it please the court. I guess I'll go back and start with the jury selection claim, the JEB claim. Just to counter the argument from appellant in regards to the Georgia Supreme Court's application of clearly established federal law, if you look at the Georgia Supreme Court's decision, it clearly lays out the relevant and applicable prima facie standard that Batson and JEB require for these types of jury selection challenges. So any notion that the trial court or the Georgia Supreme Court somehow shifted the burden and made it more burdensome on the defendant to make a prima facie showing is simply not supported in the record. Moving to their other argument in regards to an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, I think it's important to remember that the only thing that counsel put forth to the trial court to support their claim that the state was striking women disproportionately was the percentage, 75% of the peremptory strikes, and that's excluding the alternates, but that was the number that was presented to the trial court. The trial court looked at that number. The trial court also referenced the fact that the state did not challenge six women, prospective jurors, and that unchallenged female jurors did in fact end up serving on the jury. I think it also, I know the appellant has spent a good time and portion in his brief talking about the Campa decisions and the Ochoa-Vasquez decisions, and Your Honors have asked about those numbers. I'm not going to rehash the numbers. I think it's pretty clear from the state court record what the numbers were. The 36 Veneri was the number in the panel. 15 were female, 21 were male. That's a approximate 42% to 58% breakdown. There's just absolutely no Supreme Court precedent that shows the Georgia Supreme Court somehow misapplied or unreasonably applied the prima facie test that it was required to perform in this case. There really was no development of the claim at the jury selection stage. It was 75%. Here's the number, Your Honor. The court considered it, looked at the strike list, and there really wasn't any other argument offered on direct appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court. So those were the basic numbers. I would also like to point out that I believe appellant concedes in his brief as well that there were no issues in regards to specific questioning of any of the female jurors or lack thereof of questioning that appellant can point to strengthen any sort of prima facie showing that there was an inference of discriminatory intent on behalf of the state to strike female jurors. Normally that's a factor I think that would come into play, but it simply wasn't there as noted by appellant. If there are no other questions on the jury selection claim, I will move on to the ineffective assistance of counsel. As this court is aware, Strickland has said, and of course this court has said, that decisions made by attorneys, strategic decisions after a thorough investigation, which is certainly what you had here, by very experienced death penalty attorneys, are virtually unchallengeable. When you couple that with the deference afforded to a state court decision under the AEDPA, that burden becomes even harder to overcome. And this case simply is one of those rare cases that meets that burden. If you look at the decision that trial counsel was faced with, it was a simple one. They could either present this mental health component to their mitigation case, which they ultimately decided to do, which was the most strategic and reasonable decision they could make, or they could abandon it completely, and that would mean they would present none of their mental health experts, and they would be left presenting family members and a mitigation specialist. that would be have been the alternative they would have faced if they decided we're not presenting any of this mental health evidence. They certainly understood the dangers that it posed, that the state was going to call their own experts in rebuttal, and they were going to talk about things that were harmful to their mitigation case. So in turn, what they did to try to mitigate that blow was to bring it up themselves in their presentation to the jury. I think that's the epitome of reasonable attorney performance. If the state or the other side has something they're going to hit you with and you think it's going to be damaging, sometimes it's better to bring that out and try to address that the best you can in your presentation. And that's what Mr. Berry and Mr. West, trial counsel in this case, did. They presented a very thorough mitigation case. I think 15 witnesses were presented, multiple family members, numerous mental health experts who all tried to present the general mitigation case, which was petitioner's horrible upbringing, all the things associated with his childhood, coupled with this fall from a tree and an MRI that showed, they argued, showed brain damage, things of that nature, to try to at least explain to the jury how petitioner or appellant got to the place where he committed this horrible murder. So I certainly don't think when you apply Strickland in the context of the AEDPA in a case like this, there are no grounds for relief. The antisocial personality disorder, that this court has never said that it is per se aggravating, and it certainly never said that if an attorney thinks that should be part of their mitigation case or they should bring it out like in Morton because they knew it was coming out and they needed to deal with it, they thought directly that's somehow unreasonable, especially when you have the level of investigation that these attorneys put forth in this case. And of course, that's just the deficiency prong. The prejudice prong in this case, I think, presents a very big challenge for appellant. The aggravating nature of the crime itself was not going to change no matter what trial counsel said or argued or what witnesses they presented. The criminal history of this appellant and the similar transactions were not going to change no matter what mitigation defense they presented. So it's a stretch for me to see any way where simply putting forth family members and a mitigation investigator, which is essentially what appellant's saying that trial counsel should have done, would have turned the tides and established prejudice under Strickland. There's simply no justification for that. If there are no questions in regards to the ineffectiveness claim, I would briefly touch on the juror misconduct claim since Judge Newsom brought it up. Our response, if appellant is saying that the only argument for cause they're making currently is that counsel were ineffective for not presenting the argument at the motion for new trial and on direct appeal, we would counter that with that ineffectiveness claim is in itself unexhausted and therefore not a valid basis to overcome the procedural default of their juror misconduct claim. So if there are no further questions from the court, I would simply ask that the court affirm the district court's denial of federal habeas corpus relief, as I believe the jury selection claim as adjudicated by the Georgia Supreme Court and the ineffective assistance of counsel claim as adjudicated by the state habeas court were both reasonable applications of clearly established federal law, and the juror misconduct claim as found by the state habeas court was procedurally defaulted, and appellant has not shown cause and prejudice to overcome that default. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Ertl?
Thank you, Your Honor. To the extent that the state or the respondent is saying that the only thing that was presented to the trial court on the JEB issue was the percentage of strikes, that's just fundamentally wrong. The defense raised that, and then the prosecutor himself put on the record all of the strikes against women exercised by each side. Plus, the judge had the strike list, as I believe the counsel for the respondent acknowledged, and that strike list, it's part of the record, and we cite to it, shows the race and gender of each juror. So the court was keenly aware of the context that this court requires in Ochoa. So the court had all of the relevant evidence before it to make a determination on whether this pattern of strikes, when considered with the entire makeup of the veneer, as well as the race, or in this case, the gender of the juror struck, was before it. I'd also point out, Your Honors, that in this case, there was a Batson challenge based on one juror, that they struck one African-American juror, and the court there went through a full three-step Batson analysis, found that there was a prima facie case, and then made the state give race-neutral reasons and then decided the ultimate issue. So I think the court can consider that as well in deciding this case. Also, Campa, I think, is distinguishable because in that case, this court found significant that the prosecution didn't use all of their strikes against, in that case, black jurors. Here, they used all of their strikes and tried to use another. Unless there are any other questions on the JEB kit claim, I'm going to switch to ineffective assistance counsel. And I want to point out, too, that the counsel for the respondent only partially quoted Strickland. And he said, I believe he said, strategic choices made after thorough investigations are virtually unchallengeable. There is an important omission there. It really reads, strategic choices made after a thorough investigation of the law and facts relevant to plausible options are virtually unchallengeable. Here they never explored options. Tom West, who was in charge of the penalty phase, said he never considered not using mental health. Never considered it. That is not a decision. And the counsel, pardon me? Okay.
2 minutes.
Counsel for the respondent also said that justified their actions by he got out in front of it because he knew the state was going to hit them with this. Well, they could have avoided being hit at all. They just had to say, we're not going to put forth mental health evidence. And I will say it was incredibly weak. A radiologist who's trained to read the MRIs said there's nothing wrong with it. As a matter of fact, reached out when he found out that the defense expert was going to say there was something represented in the MRI, reached out to him to say, you're wrong. Don't be and then they also knew that the state doctors, who also had a look at the MRI, said there was nothing there. And what's really important is the fact that the medical records from that fall are devoid of anything indicating there was any kind of brain damage. Never lost consciousness. They did an X-ray of the neck and the head and found there was nothing there. The best that the defense experts could say was a fall like that has got to shake your head a little bit. So they had scant evidence of brain damage. And to rely on that, to then introduce such damning evidence of psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder is unreasonable. This court's precedents show we don't have to complete the pictures, as somebody suggested, because there are dozens of cases in this court saying introducing stuff like antisocial personality disorder is harmful. And it wasn't ineffective not to present it. So we would ask, we think, one final point. I believe the state courts, the state habeas court, and trial counsel, as a matter of fact, were operating under the misconception that mitigation has to explain the crime. Kennard v. Dredge very clearly says mitigation does not have to be tethered to the offense. There was no reason to explain the crime. I don't think there's any argument that they were going to make the jury like Mr. Ledford. They weren't going to be able to explain the crime, and they weren't going to be able to get rid of the prior convictions. The only thing they had the option of doing is presenting some evidence that might give the jury reason to exercise mercy. And by failing to do that, and in fact, introducing harmful evidence, they rendered an ineffective assistance to counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ertl. We have your case, and we will be in recess.
Thank you.